Okay, good evening. Welcome to tonight's Monroe City Council meeting. This is the study session meeting for Tuesday, August 21st, 2018. The time right now is 7 p.m. Ms. Atkinson, will you please call the roll?
Certainly. Council members present and establishing a quorum are Scarborough, Rasmussen, Davis, Camp, and Gamble.
Thank you. And we heard from Councilmember Cutaback last week or the week before that she would not be here this evening, so unless there's objection, we'll go ahead and consider her absence as excused. We'll go ahead and announce for the record when Councilmember Hanford enters chambers. Councilmember Gamble, will you please lead us in the pledge?
Yep.
Thank you.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and move on to public comments. Ms. Atkinson, do we have any public comments this evening?
Yes, we do.
Thank you.
Huge spider. Where?
There's a spider?
Where?
It is a big spider. Please let the record show there's a spider on the wall behind us.
Not for long.
Chair Tuttle says not for long.
Thank you.
The spider is now gone.
Yes.
Okay, so we have two people who have signed up to speak this evening. The first person is Rosie Tattle. Ms. Tattle, please come on forward, and the podium's over there this evening. Thank you.
I'm going to be a little bit more choppy because originally I thought Republic Garbage would be here, and I just want to say a little bit for you to say anyway. I was thinking of something different that becomes delayed. I saw a report on TV that they're having trouble getting their usual chain of using the recycled stuff after, since China's changed some of the rules, even though their competition waste management is still not getting from China, not bringing it to China, and they're still whatever. If they do continually have trouble with finding avenues for it, I was wondering if garbage prices would go up or how that would affect the whole thing. And maybe, and one of the things on this report was people aren't recycling correctly. I even see plastic bags which shouldn't be in the recycling bin. Maybe is that part of the thing? I was wondering if we could ask our garbage thing that question. I'm passionate about recycling because when I was growing up, I said, itty bitty hill keep growing. The hill is a landfill. So I am adamant about, and I was wondering when that does come, maybe if that's part of the questions we can ask them. I'm going to show one more visual of how passionate I am. This was made for the fair to try to encourage people to recycle. And this has different things that people can do and how it affects the environment. So as you talk to them about different things, I'm wondering how that's going to come into play. If they don't have the money they get from recycling, are they going to keep costs up? And will that affect how many drivers we have and other things?
All right. Thank you very much. We'll make certain that we have those questions shared with Republic so they can respond to them when they come
okay,
in a couple weeks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, actually, I did the design. My husband did the printing. I did the sewing, and he did the quilting.
Very cool.
I can print
that. Thank you. The next person who signed up to speak this evening is Jill Warner. Ms. Warner, please come on forward. Thank you for coming this evening.
Sure. I'm following up with a question that was asked in mid-July, following up on the 4th of July and the fireworks in our community. I was told by one of your representatives that tonight would be the night that you would address that, so I'm here to find out what that entails. The second is that it appears that CPAC is building another community behind ours. And I have come to talk to the city and ask how can we protect ourselves because these trucks are barreling through our communities? And logically, I'm thinking, why aren't they using Foothill as opposed to 131st and then goes over to 161st? Can anything be done? Because they are going at breakneck speed at times with the truck, which you can't stop on a dime. I have made the police department aware of this and asked if a officer could just kind of sit by Evergreen Heights. I don't know what that street is right in front of their community and just kind of observe. So those are the two high-level items that I'm following up on. Again, I'm very concerned about the fire works that are going on here. I'm from California. We don't allow that pretty much everywhere for obvious reasons. And I want to keep our communities intact. And I know everyone is saying, well, this is our right, it's legal. But I say, folks, we got trees around us. We see what's going on in the air. And this is our new norm. So I'm just bringing it to the forefront to basically see where everyone stands on this. And also, the drone issue. I never did hear anyone get back to me as to what is the stand that Monroe takes for having these drones fly over. They can be very problematic. And so do we have anything in place? Do we foresee anything being put in place? Because our privacies are being intruded upon. No notification, it seems, that anyone was aware of that they were flying over, and I did, and it was coming from Amazon, and I did force the engineers to land it immediately, because if you don't give people notice, then you don't have the right to do that. That's my thinking. So those are my questions.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please let the record show that Councilmember Hanford entered chambers at 7:07. Thank you. All right. Anybody else like to come forward to give public comment this evening? Okay, seeing none, we'll go ahead and move on with the agenda. The first item that we have on here is councilmember reports. Are there any councilmember reports this evening? All right, seeing none, staff and department reports. Are there any staff or department reports this evening? Okay, sounds good. Next item then is mayor and administrative reports. Do we have any reports this night?
I just have two to report out. One is there was a request to send property owners in the downtown area a letter describing what the zoning code requirements are. We recently had an issue with a property owner moving in a business that wasn't allowed in that zone, and I just wanted to let council know that that letter is ready to go out, and it should be out on Friday or Monday of this next week. The second one I have is just to remind the City Council, this was a question that came up last week, about the Economic Development Advisory Board, and we are letting out the second set of applications to serve on that board, and we'll be bringing back to council a resolution to establish a full-time Economic Development Advisory Board. And so those appointments should be ready to take place at the end of September.
Okay. Any questions, council members? Okay. Anything further?
Nothing for me. Thank you.
Okay. And I don't have anything. Actually, I guess I do have a couple things to report this evening. The most significant thing that we have going on this week is that tomorrow night we do have the one police chief candidate that is coming forward. As you'll recall, last week I told you that we had two police chief candidates. One of them decided not to proceed. I then had another police chief candidate come in addition to the one that we have. I drove him around town. He's decided to accept a conditional offer at another jurisdiction. And so I have one police chief candidate. These three people that that made the top were excellent candidates. We had a great batch of folks, and so we're going to go ahead and continue with the process. Tomorrow night will be a community meet and greet. I think that's 6:30 to 7:30.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Thanks. That's 6:30 to 7:30 at the Monroe Boys and Girls Club. And I would encourage everybody to come and meet the candidate. His name is Jeff Jolly. And I sent an email of his biography, his background information to each of you. He's currently working as a chief of police in Oregon and had previously worked in Utah. He's got administrative experience in addition to having worked his way up through the ranks from working as a police officer. So he's, again, he's somebody that has both a background in administration, including budgeting and management, and is currently serving in that kind of position, and again, has that experience that that comes from having worked as a police officer. We then have three panels that will be interviewing him on Thursday, and a couple of you here will be on those panels. We will then have lunch with him, and then we will have one more series of interviews in the afternoon. If after going through that process, the feedback that I get from folks sounds like things look good, then I would anticipate moving forward with the next phase, with an appointment coming forward to the council for consideration of confirmation. All right. Does anybody have any questions about any of that? Mr. Jensen?
Does he know he's the only candidate left?
I would imagine that he would receive a copy of that press release.
Okay.
So, yeah. It's important to me that we have the right fit. And so we've done a lot to vet the candidates that came forward. I feel confident that this is an individual that would work well for our community. But, again, I want everybody to go in with an open mind, so I'm not going to say more. I'd like people to have an opportunity to meet the person, and I want honest and sincere feedback about what you think about the candidate before we continue with the process. So I'm looking forward to hearing from folks on Thursday. Any other questions? All right. So that's the most significant thing. Oh, and then we also have the Fair Days Parade on Saturday. And I think that's it. Okay, moving on then to, does anybody have any questions for me? All right, moving on to discussion items. Council members, would you, since we have a member of the public here with an interest in hearing the firework discussion, is there in the planning conversation could take about 30 to 45 minutes, would there be an interest from council to amend the agenda to move the fireworks discussion to item number one? Okay, I have a motion from Councilmember Gamble to make that amendment. Second from Councilmember Scarborough to amend the agenda to move the firework discussion item number three to number one. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes 6-0. All right. Mr. Dickerson, are you giving the presentation on this?
Chief, did you want to scoot the podium forward any bit? I don't know if that would be helpful.
Here?
It's up to you how far you want to be back.
You seemed like you were in the next county.
You're right.
I know, sir. It was a spider, wasn't it?
Well, I'm going to take a break because I don't want you to talk to me about it. I was tasked by the mayor to look at calls for service during the 4th of July. We actually were tasked with maybe getting call for service over a three-year period or over a five-year period, and we were able to obtain statistics for a three-year period. And I have a chart there that you're getting now that basically has the calls for service for all cities in Snohomish County. We were also asked to look at cities who banned fireworks and then maybe go back 3 years, see what the calls for service were prior to the ban, and then maybe 3 years prior or after the ban. And we were, I looked at our comparable cities that we kind of compare with, we use for negotiations with the union and stuff like that. And those cities are Aberdeen, Battleground, Bonnie Lake, Centralia, Enumclaw, Gig Harbor, Oak Harbor, Port Angeles, and Port Orchard, Port Townsend, Paulsboro, Sumner, and Tumwater. We sent out requests to some. Only five of them, five of them had bans, eight of them didn't. So we looked at the five, and part of the problem is some of these cities put the bans on in the 80s, the 90s, and it's really difficult to get information. So we sent emails to some of the cities requesting information on prior to the ban and also after the ban. And we only got a response from one city, and that city was Port Angeles. And to kind of give you an idea, they could only give us 1 year. And to kind of give you an idea of what they said, which was rather interesting. The firework ban went into effect 2016. In 2015, the year prior, we had 139 calls for service. And then after the ban, they had 57 calls for service. So there actually was, you know, once the rule was there, it seemed to slow down. But also in looking at some of the statistics in Snohomish County, you're going to see that, you know, they may have, after, you know, in 2006, they were low, they were high in 2007, then they were low again in 2018. We kind of wanted to go over that little chart a little bit with you here. I looked at, you know, our city to kind of give you an idea. In Monroe in 2006, we had 13 calls for service. And in 2017, it dropped to 8. And then in 2018, we had 13 calls for service. And I took four cities in the county that, you know, were similar. Mount Lake Terrace, actually looked at Mill Creek, Mount Lake Terrace, Mukilteo, and Arlington to kind of do somewhat of a comparison. And Arlington has a population of 19,000 people, 19 plus, I should say. And basically, they had 23 calls for service in 16, 22, that's total for over 2 days, the 4th and the 5th, 22 calls for service. And then they had in 18, they had 23 calls for service. Mount Lake Terrace has about 21 plus thousand people. And in 6, they had 06, they or 16, they had 34 calls for service. They had 24 in 17, and they had 19 in 18. And then in Mukilteo, which and their ban went into effect in 1993, they had 25, 34, and 19. And then you get down to Mill Creek, and they had 8, and we had more. Only they had 8 or no, they yeah, they had actually they had 16 and we had like 13 or no, let's see here, too many numbers getting mixed up here a little bit. They had 8 calls in 16, we had 13. Then they had 18 more than we had, and then they had 16 more than we had. All these cities had more calls responses than we had. And the only, even Briar, if you look at Briar, which is a smaller city, they had more calls over those 3 years. I'm just, you know, I'm not here to tell you what to do. You're going to tell me what to do, but I'm just kind of giving you an idea of the calls for service we found. You know, we kind of fell in there with Salt and Gold Bar and some of the smaller cities in calls for service. Now, you know, I talked with some of the officers. I talked to one of the sergeants in particular, and he said that it's different when you're out there working the road on the 4th than it is when you look at the statistics, because sometimes a lot of people don't call in. There's a lot of things going on out there. I told him that I was going to mention that, you know, because, you know, there's a lot of people that don't call in. And there are people, when you have a ban in place, they know it's a violation of the law, so they do call in. So it I don't think we had any we had no injuries last year as far as the police response goes, and you know, the smaller cities, the contract with the county, their figures might go into the counties also. I don't know that. So, you know, Salton, you know, they had three. Those also might be included in the county because they contract with the county. You know, with the statistics that we have, it's, you know, I mean, we're able to respond to it. That's what I'm saying. So, does anybody have any questions?
reference to those issues here.
Yes, Councilmember Scarborough.
Hi, Chief. Hi. How many house fires did we have?
None this year, but in 17, I heard we had two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe.
And when you talk about these bands, 16, we're talking about within the city limits?
Correct.
Okay. So I'm assuming that we're looking at whether or not we want to ban fireworks within the city limits, not outside the city limits.
So we have no jurisdiction outside city limits.
Okay, so we're going to talk about that more.
Well, the council following the 4th of July last year wanted to come back and discuss the fireworks regulations, and so that's what we're doing here tonight.
Do you want me to speak to that now, or do you want to wait for that?
Do you have anything further to present? This would be an appropriate time to do that, council member.
Okay, our concerns, and Patsy, Councilman Cutterback and I both wanted to hear about this a little bit more because of the effects that the fireworks have on people, have on property, have on pets, have on PTSD veterans, that is becoming more talked about than it has in the past, at least the veterans. I don't know. I believe there might be enough fireworks around having the fairgrounds that within the city limits, there could be enough show. And if you stand where I live, you can see the show all the way out to the valley and up to Gold Bar and across the valley to the other side here. And I'd like to discuss banning them in the city limits. I would like to be talked out of why it shouldn't be done. I'm kind of in this. Get your name again.
Jill.
Because we've had quite a few. We've had several complaints at city council meetings about people in the neighborhoods not cleaning up after themselves. I know they seem to say they do, but the people that are in the neighborhood have it floating into their yards, and it's not what's out in the street any as much as what it is in their yards. Are people irresponsible? Some are, some aren't. We're not talking about the people that take responsibility for what they do with them. We're talking about the people that don't. The people that don't are the ones that are probably don't care about anybody else's concerns. So that's kind of my position, and I'll yield to any comments.
Okay, so I understand that you're finished?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Camp? I'm sorry, I didn't see who was up first.
The other
Camp. Councilmember Gamble and then Councilmember Camp.
So this one I always... So I personally, I don't light off fireworks. I think it's, I like watching them, but I think it's like lighting a $20 bill on fire or whatever. When I was a kid, I absolutely loved them. The problem that I have is, talk you out of, actually in your statement when you said that you're not talking about the people that are being responsible. The part that I struggle with is that when we start, and it's the same thing for me, whether you're talking this type of stuff or even in a company or in a school or whatever, when you start managing to the exception, when you start creating laws, rules, legislations because we're trying to deal with the one-off. We've seen a lot of statistics in the past as well. These are just calls. We've seen stuff from the fire department that has also showed where we have bans. A lot of the fireworks that are being lit off currently right now in the city limits are illegal. They go to the reservation, they bring them back from the reservation, they're not legal fireworks, and they light them off. And the areas that do have bans, these are real calls right here. These are real people lighting them off. When you compare the statistics that, look at, fire, house fires or whatever, the whole concept of, I agree, any one house fire is a bad, is a bad house fire. I don't think anybody's going to disagree with that. It's caused by fireworks. But we can't manage life in that way. That's the way that, I look at that. Because if we use that logic, you're going to legislate everything. right? So that's where I struggle with this. I really do, because I get just as many comments about, and I even have it in my own neighborhood, even though I'm not there on the 4th of July. In fact, you know, I go east of the mountains for the 4th of July, but how much of a community event it is for the cul-de-sac. I mean, they have their deal, they go out, they pick it up, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then when I started looking into the, you know, the impact, because we've got a lot of the other stuff, of what it has on the institutions, the nonprofits that earn money off of the safe, you know, fireworks, I'm just really reluctant to say, hey, let's just put a ban and problem solved. And we don't have any sort of, without an enforcement plan, you know, on the other side. And we've heard even from the previous, you know, police chief that, hey, we could put a plan on it tomorrow. And, you know, really, what are we, there's not a lot we could do. You know, maybe we'll get a different view on that. But I really struggle with us taking action and legislation when you have a group of people that don't like fireworks, and I get it. I mean, my dad's a vet, vets in the family, people that struggle with that type of stuff. You know, he leaves, whatever the case. But when you try to legislate everything, it just gets really, 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 really sticky. And I have a problem with that. So, you know, my personal opinion is I have seen nothing, Kirk, in the data that shows, yes, absolutely, this is of the utmost, you know, safety, it's imminent. The one thing that I was interested in when we originally started this was, can we put something in place that when it just seems responsible from the standpoint of, hey, we haven't had rain in, you know, 2 months, which we had, but that was the original conversation when this first came, was, you know, hey, we've had a drought, it's really, really bad, can we curtail it? And that's when we found out that we couldn't because of the law that said that you have to wait a year, it has to be a year in advance can put any sort of ban in place, primarily because of the number of 501c3s that depend and put that into their revenue source and their budgets for the following fiscal year, because everybody does their budgets the year before, it's like we are doing. So there's a big impact there. So I'm more inclined to look at something like that. But the funny thing was is that just by having that conversation, I don't know if you guys remember this from that year, we didn't have any problems. We had, you know, a lot of people chose elected because we put the word out to not do their normal displays because of how the weather was, all that kind of stuff. And oh my gosh, be golly, common sense took over because the community went together, and we didn't need to pass a law in order to do that. So that's just kind of my view on it.
Okay, thank you, Councilmember Kemp.
I was just thinking about your last comment that it didn't work at my house. My darling daughter. Anyway, I have a question. So the places that did have the ban or have the ban in place, is there a reduction in fireworks displays, or just regardless of a ban or not, you're going to have World War II?
Well, I come from Olympia, and Olympia, Tumwater, and Lacey, all three have bans on that. And on the 4th of July, it's like Fort Lewis is setting off whatever. I mean, they go off all over the place.
So it's really...
It's very... The only way you're ever going to put a stop to it is you eliminate the Native Americans selling. Because people can... You know, we got the Nisqually Reservation, right. You got the Tulalip, that's where they get it.
Thank you. That was my question. What we've had this discussion in the past, I pointed out my wasted youth where we actually made our own fireworks out of whatever materials were around, which were absolutely unsafe and insane. And I agree with your position. My brother-in-law was back from Vietnam, and I watched him almost jump from a ladder because he thought there was incoming. It was the weirdest thing I've ever seen. I don't see what I spent time in Longview this last 4th of July, and there were displays. People had their own thing, but it wasn't quite as explosive as it is around here. But they also have a lot of public displays.
Rather than an outright ban, I'm wondering if maybe we should start thinking about having more public displays. Not the fair, but, and you can see it from your house. I can kind of see it from my house. What if we start thinking about having a public display on Lake Ty? That's where they do it in Monk. They have a similar urban lake, and they put a barge out in the middle of it and start setting things up. I don't know if we get donations for it. But asking the people to redirect their festivities, maybe have some sparklers around the house if you pick Little Pete's and whatever that other $20 bill they want to burn up in the middle of the street. But park and then go down to the lake and have a party and have a little picnic and watch the fireworks there. It might be an opportunity. You wouldn't have to pay for it. You have to pay to get into the races to see the, right? Maybe we should start leaning in that direction as a possibility. I agree with you. I've seen the impact, and I've almost blown my fingers off a few times. So I agree with you, but I don't think we're going to have we may be able to redirect people, but I don't think we'll be able to have an effect of a ban. I think people are going to still buy them or build them and blow them off in the street. That's my take on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember Camp. Councilmember Hanford.
Thank you. I concur with what Councilmember Gamble said. I think you spelled it out pretty clearly. I'll just add that it does add community when the whole cul-de-sac gets together and not just lights off fireworks, but barbecues and picnics. And I really like your idea there about the lake time. That's good.
Thank you. Before I go to Councilmember Scarborough, I'd like to go ahead and solicit feedback from Councilmember Rasmussen and Councilmember Davis. Do you two have something to weigh in on fireworks? Councilmember Rasmussen?
And without being redundant, you know, I think the biggest thing for me is the unfortunate piece of it. Seeing the statistics that were presented to us tonight, I was pleasantly surprised where they're at. I was expecting something a lot higher. Truth be told, it comes down to unfortunate, and the only way that that's going to be controlled is that they're completely taken away in all areas. So, yeah. That's the main piece for me.
Okay. Thank you, Councilmember Davis.
Yeah, I agree with Councilmember Gamble. The other Gamble. to me, it's all about like burning $20 bills. I love watching my neighbors burn these places. That's how exciting this can be. And they do every year. It's fun. To me, it's a tradition. It's something I've always enjoyed. I understand the inherent danger in it. But again, we can only protect people so much. You know. We can prevent house fires by decreeing that all houses be made out of cinder blocks and steel roofs. But so it becomes the reality is it becomes where do we draw the line. Mm-hmm. I think we made some changes in the last year, and I think this last year from my area, I think I saw the difference. It was not as wild as it's been in the last a few years back. It seemed a lot more controlled. In that shorter period of time, it actually worked. It was like 2 days. It was not a whole week of you know, dogs, you know, going crazy and big bangs and at 2 a.m. That didn't happen. So I think there was a positive effect to some of the changes that we made. Yeah. And I would say let that continue, because I think that was a positive move, and I'm happy with that. But I agree with what you were saying. And that's pretty much word for word what I would say, so appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you. So I'm hearing a consensus to not proceed with more on this topic. Is that... I don't think anybody's disagreeing. Councilmember Scarborough?
First off, being a veteran, I don't have a problem with it. I don't have enough PTSD to have that worry me, although a loud bang can drive me in that direction. I don't have to deal with it. But some of the things that have gone around the table, I don't disagree with. I thought that was a good idea from Councilman Canton. But here we are, we're talking about something we don't want to ban because we can't enforce it. Well, we tried to ban alcohol in the 30s. We couldn't enforce it, so we changed. And now we have quite a problem with drunk driving and people killing people who don't drink. But we shouldn't legislate to those people because then we're not talking about the people who don't drink. So, and as far as enforcement, I don't think the enforcement is you're going to stop it. The enforcement part is if somebody does something wrong, you can. There's a price to pay for it. Enforce is punishment, if you want to put it that way. As far as fireworks this year, I don't know about some of the neighborhoods, but in my neighborhood, it was horrendous. And as twice as bad as last year. The only thing that was different this year, and I'll concede to, I don't remember who said it, I think it was Councilman Davis. It wasn't 3 or 4 days long, it was 2 days. But in the past, it's been 3 or 4 days before, well, no, at least 2 days before, maybe three, and at least a day afterwards. And, you know, if your animals and your people that are bothered only had a day to deal with it, and you know, that would be one thing. But when it turns out to be 3 or 4 or 5 days, it's a different story. And I don't want to ban an American way of life. That's not what I'm asking about here. I'm telling you that there's American way of life that can be seen from the fairgrounds or Lake Tahoe in the city limits. We don't have to jeopardize people's homes, their pets, their own fingers, things like that. So those are my concerns.
Thank you. Okay, and I think everybody, I'm sorry, Councilmember Camp.
I just want to address one point. So as opposed, would there be a possibility of one day? We're reduced down to 2 or 3 days?
Just one day. It's, well, July 4th.
Right.
And then January, sorry.
Oh, so we are down to effectively.
Yeah, December 31st and January 4th.
All right.
I'm sorry, July 4th.
It's just the same.
You know, that 4th.
It's just a J.
Right. And it seems like every Seahawk game.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know that. Just throwing that
one
out.
One of the victories.
So we're already at that point.
Yeah.
It's moving.
Yeah. Okay. Councilmember Gamble.
No, and I would. It's a great point to point out. I mean, that we reduced the sale time period. With the it's still it's illegal to light them off, other than the 4th of July.
Correct. Yes.
Or the 31st. So we need to call. I mean, all that stuff that happens, the 2 days before and 3 days before, 4 days after, whatever. You can make a phone call now. I mean, that's, you can do it. It's illegal. It's a ban.
Yep. All right, and you know, one of the things I think that I heard around the table, in addition to enforcement and things along those lines, was also the availability of fireworks. Is that, you know, unlike maybe when I was a kid growing up on the East Coast, you know, the Commonwealth of Virginia had laws related to fireworks. We had access to fireworks that they had. Well, things are different here in Washington. First, you know, you can now order things online and have things delivered. That didn't exist when I was a kid. You know, there was a Sears and Roebuck calendar catalog, but it didn't have fireworks in there. And you also have tribal properties here. They govern under a different set of regulations between ordering things online and being able to just take a 30-minute drive. You're able to get things that that aren't under the same regulations as within the state of Washington itself. So, for me, you know, one of the things that would help the situation relative to illegal fireworks would be the state of Washington finding a better way to regulate illegal fireworks coming into the state and coming off tribal properties. So there is really a much larger issue that that affects all the communities in the area, which is why even when you make them illegal, you still have people launching those larger illegal fireworks. Just some thoughts. Councilmember Gamble.
Yeah, no, it's a great point, and actually, you know, you could make the counter argument that if you take over, you know, away our, you know, selling them in the city of Monroe, because essentially you have a ban, but all you're doing is just redistributing folks to go to an area where they can purchase illegal fireworks, whereas if you have it in town, just as the mayor said, but in addition to that, not only when they buy them in town, are they legal and safe guidelines that they're going out. I know exactly, I know it's an oxymoron, but you're still blowing stuff up. It's way better than what's out on the on, you know, on the tribal property. But that money is also going to a local organization, 501c3, for good cause. So you're just moving and redistributing the money that's going to be spent, a lot of that, and potentially more dangerous fireworks. So.
Okay. All right. So I'm not hearing an interest in bringing this back for another discussion this year. All right, we're done with this topic then for now. We'll go ahead and move on to the next item on the agenda. We're going to pick up then on AB, so the discussion item number one, which was adjusted by an amendment to the agenda earlier. This is now agenda item number two. It's AB 18-174, Unified Development Regulations Project Update. Mr. Swanson.
Great. Thank you, Mayor. Council. So the Planning Commission is in attendance tonight for the joint meeting, and again, the commissioners, feel free to pop up your name tag and chime in at any point during that conversation, and that's kind of the general purpose of this is. And so this is essentially our second check-in for the update to the new Unified Development Regulations. And so you'll see in your packet there's quite a few pages in there. We wanted to include a lot of the draft chapters. Planning Commission and staff have been working very hard at trying to get this done this year. We're a little behind schedule. We had a lot of current development that we've had to dedicate some time to, and some buildable lands analysis that took a little longer than we thought, but we still want to finish it up by the end of the year. The last time that we had this joint meeting, there were a few hot topics that were brought up that generated quite a bit of discussion, and one of those was our light industrial zone. And what is it now, and what should we do with it? And if you remember, our current code allows the both essentially commercial uses and light industrial uses within that zone. So it's not truly a light industrial zone or a commercial zone. It allows everything across the board. And so that was a big thing that we discussed, and ultimately ended up is we needed more data. And so that's what we did. Staff went out and we hired a group called Community Attributes, and they're a data group. They've been around Seattle for quite some time, and a very good firm to go to for this kind of work. And they generated, it's the first bunch of papers in your packet that essentially identify or that contain that report. And so in that report, and went through and you know did its kind of standard data gathering, and then towards the very end it had its findings in there. And so with that you'll see, because the big questions that kind of came out with is, well, what should we do with our light industrial lands? What's the best bang for our buck? We only have so much land. We know it's a changing dynamic. We know Seattle is doing a lot of rezoning, and you see their industrial kind of leaving those areas for either being zoned out or just the price is too much. We also have up north, we have the Marysville-Arlington light industrial area. You know, what should we do with this land? And what Community Attributes ultimately came back is you know, hold on to your industrial land. That's one of those things that is in demand right now. Even we have areas just down the road in Woodinville where people are being priced out, and also what should we do with the land? And some of the topics were you know, wineries or breweries, and they said that's probably a really good market considering the cost of rent going up. They mentioned Kenmore in here, have an area called Brew Row down there that, again, their prices are going up. Obviously, Bothell prices are going up and Woodinville prices are going up. And so that may be a kind of a great attractant to the area and a good use for the brewing of beer. And with that, they also noted that there should be some retail use associated with that, or, you know, in many cases, tasting rooms. And so, you know, one of the ideas that we had discussed was, you know, limiting it down to a percentage for, you know, potentially like 25% of the actual building area that would be dedicated towards a tasting room or a restaurant. But it also acknowledged that there was a need for just some regular retail commercial down there, and that kind of gets back to our discussion that we had about designating a chunk. Because if you remember, we talked about these light industrial or these legal non-conforming uses that are uses that are there now, that if we went pure industrial would be a legal non-conforming use. An example of that is the restaurants over there. And so when we went through and the analysis did acknowledge that there is need for some retail or restaurants, and I know that we had discussed a little bit last time, I gave you a, handed out a map here, and it has multiple different layers on there for various discussion points throughout the evening. But if you see an area on there that says retail services overlay, and it's essentially the X area, two things out of the report, it mentioned some need potentially for retail restaurants in there to actually serve that light industrial area, but also the potential for new businesses to go into that benefit Lake Tai, you know, whether that be kind of a recreational use as a kayak rentals, as a something along those lines that could potentially go in there one day. So that was the area that was initially talked about. Planning Commission didn't have an opportunity to actually kind of fully finish out this conversation, so you're still kind of in the discussion phase as this is presented to you. So with that, I'll go ahead and stop for a second and breathe and allow people to ask questions or start discussion.
Okay. Are there any questions? Okay. Planning Commissioners, what sort of thoughts would you like to hear from council members on this topic? We do the joint meeting here in part so that you can hear from council members what sort of vision, what sort of policies they're interested in. So what sort of questions do you have for the council? Go ahead and put your... Chair Tuttle, go ahead.
Thank you. Well, last time we were here, thank you, we were talking about, I think there were three different options with this, the X'd out area, and then talking about the breweries and the other things. So, I think that was about 6 months ago. So in this time, in our discussion, and then after getting that report back, we kind of funneled back down into, instead of creating an area specifically intended for breweries, distilleries, and cider houses or whatever those are called, just allowing those anyway because they are manufacturing, and then as with some of the other businesses, allowing but not requiring a small retail area if somebody wanted to do that. And so we kind of brought it all the way back to the beginning where now we're just looking at those buildings. So that if something like Burger Madness went out of business, another restaurant could go in there because right now it would be, those businesses are legal non-conforming. So we need to know if this seems like an acceptable direction. Is this what the council would like to see in these areas, specifically the gray area and then the areas that are X'd out? Because they were much bigger last time we were here, and we had, I think it was three different ideas for dealing with that area. So for me specifically, we're going to continue in this direction unless we hear that we think we should be looking at something different.
Okay, so then the question to pose to council, is there any objection to the direction that the Planning Commission is currently going on this topic? Any questions, any feedback? Councilmember Camp.
Wow.
I saw you reaching for it.
I just want an explanation about the $140,000. Wasn't that on the back?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
$140,000?
Well. Was not being pushy.
I didn't see that. We don't have this thing.
Oh, the budget.
Yeah, the 2017 budget. I'm confused. It's for 2017.
Copy and paste here.
This is money that you have from 2017.
So we're thinking that it may be a copy and paste error from a previous agenda bill.
Okay.
We're not. Staff isn't asking for another $140,000 for the.
So this was already signed 2017.
Correct.
So there's no fiscal impact.
Correct. It's all carried over.
Sorry, typo, sir.
Yeah.
I was like, those are some expensive red X's.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm in the wrong business. I need to get in the red X business. Right?
Thank you for catching that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's 140 for the entire UDR out.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I saw the date and then I saw the number and I thought, isn't it 2018 or aren't we looking at 2019?
We're amending the 2017 budget. It's all good.
It's going to the Cayman Island account.
Our second Hermione did it.
So. You're on the public record.
All right. Probably shouldn't joke. Anything further, Councilmember Campbell?
I've done, thank you.
All right, Councilmember Gamble.
So, just going back in my head in the preamble there. So, we put them in the state that there are now because we wanted to hold on to our industrial land. That was the reason why we did that, correct?
Did
we made that the decision to base, they're legal non-conforming now because we said, hey, we're just going to make this industrial. Is that, did I miss?
They're allowed right now. They're allowed. Moving.
Oh, they're allowed in that area.
Yeah.
Oh, but we were changing the allowable uses in that zone and that's what happened. So they were going to become not allowed.
Correct.
Okay. The zoning,
so the zoning never changed.
Okay. This is that's a proposal. Yeah.
That's what I need a clarification on. Legal non-conforming to me is like there was a zoning change and there was a reason why we did it.
It was the allowable use change.
Got it. It was allowable
with breaking up the industrial and the commercial zones with the in the comp plan process.
No, I'm good. I just anytime there's that, it's like okay, there was a reason why we did the other. So.
But we didn't. One of the things we didn't necessarily want to do was expand that retail and restaurant area into other parts of that zone because we want to retain the industrial use, but in the areas where it's already built out for that, it makes sense to just keep that there, and it does work off of the Lake Tai, and it does serve the people who work in those zones over on that end of town. So.
Yep.
And it's supported by the industrial lands market profile that council recommended additional studies. So this is basically bringing the topic back because the additional study was done.
Okay, good. No, I...
Okay.
Full support.
All right. Any other questions on this topic from planning commissioners or direction from council? All right. I don't hear any objection to the current direction.
Excellent.
All right. Next item.
So...
I was going to say, did we already do that?
Yeah.
The polka-dotted area?
1, 2, 3. No, not yet.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm not sure how familiar council is with the airport overlay zone. And so this essentially, you'll see on your map, and Shannon went ahead and labeled everything out, airport protection zones. And they're labeled 1 through 5, actually 6. On this map, and so I'll start off with that, just explaining that a little bit. So, what happened is in the state law required cities to start protecting their airports, and there's essentially a paragraph in the RCWs that basically directs cities, in the interest of transportation, to start offering protections around airports. And what Washington State Department of Transportation went ahead and did is they developed some guidance for protecting the airports that includes crash zones. And you'll see in the zones right here, you have the one-way runway protection zone, inner zone, inner turning zone, outer turning zone. What you really want to focus on is essentially those zones 1 through 4. And so when WashDOT developed that guidance, we essentially took that from Washington State Department of Transportation and overlaid it on our airport. And so there's been a lot of talk, throughout code updates, especially when we're updating our critical areas, about best available science. And so as staff, we're always going out and we're looking for the experts on the subject matter. And so WashDOT just happened to be the experts in this area. And so we grabbed their guidance and overlaid it on our airport. And so this happened roughly in, I want to say, 2004, 2006. Is when Monroe was originally required to do this. And so once that went into play, it actually created quite a few restrictions where those overlays go, specifically in 5, not so much, but 1 through 4 really did start impacting properties. And what it does is it regulates both uses and it regulates densities. And so when you have commercial uses, and commercial uses typically have a higher density, it starts prohibiting those uses within those areas. And if you remember, Tom Etterer, owner of Eastside Masonry, came in and has talked to council a few times. He's also been in a talk with Planning Commission a few times. And he's, looking at redeveloping his property. Well, he's right in the middle of one of those zones that substantially restricts his density. And so he's currently zoned light industrial under the comprehensive plan and the proposed zoning, he would be zoned commercial. His thing that he came back to and told Planning Commission, I don't remember if he told council this, I have no problem with commercial. I'd love to build commercial on that site. However, the density doesn't allow it or allow me to build a commercial structure on that site. One thing that we did during this code amendment is we went back and we re-looked at WSDOT's guidance on it, and they updated it in 2011. We took it and we brought everything down to its most liberal level possible under that guidance, but there's still substantial restrictions on many of these parcels as far as what you can do. We, you know, provided clarity. We did as much as we could under that, but it still has restrictions on these parcels. And so with Mr. Adder's testimony and then discussion between staff and Planning Commission, the idea was, why don't we come up with a hybrid zone for this area? Because if you look on your map and you see that commercial slash light industrial zone and it's polka dotted, right now the comprehensive plan designation for that area is commercial. And so with commercial, we can go many different directions on it, just like you can with the comp plan designation of you know, low density residential. You can go off on, you know, 3 units per acre, 4 units per acre, 5 units per acre. Well, with commercial, it's the same way. If an example is in our current zoning code, we have both general commercial and we have service commercial. You look at the underlying comp plan designation, it's just commercial. And so they decided, well, potentially we just take this and make it a hybrid zone. So those areas like Tom Edder's property and even the property at South Tim, you'll see a lot of equipment parked on there. They're potentially looking at redeveloping, is that they would have these options for redevelopment down there as far as building a light industrial facility where you essentially have very few workers but a larger storage area, so you get that population down for that area. And so that was, again, we just kind of finished this up at one of a recent meeting, so it's still kind of on the table for discussion, but that's where everything ended.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Gamble.
Yeah, no, I remember this discussion quite a bit. I don't want to say 6 years ago or whenever it was a while ago or 5 years ago. I am all for figuring out what is this, you know, gives us the most flexibility for that area.
Yeah.
I really, really am. And I mean, we need to be safe, responsible, and we've had proposals even in the past where they were going to sell the airport, you know, and so that there's a little handcuff, you know, going on here because we view it as, you know, hey, it's great for the community. You got an airport, and there's different things we can, you know, do there. But then at times it was going to go away, and there was going to be a motel there. I mean, we've gone through every, you know, iteration, so kind of being caught in that limbo. I'm all for whatever type of flexibility we can do there, because right now we've got an eyesore. I mean, really, a graffiti haven is really what it's become, unfortunately, in that location there. So I'm 100% supportive of whatever flexibility we can give within the rules.
Anything further, Councilmember?
Nope,
okay. Councilmember Camp.
So, do we still have the height restriction limits on this? And I can't remember what that is. Like 3 stories or something.
The height restriction I think currently matches up with the airport height restriction. Currently matches up, I believe, with our zoning code height restriction. The height restriction I don't think has been the issue in the past. It's been mostly the density issue and the allowed uses.
Okay. And a few years ago, There were, in addition to the airport going away, there was discussion about expanding the airport so it could accommodate some different class of airplane. Would that affect this?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Just by enlarging? Uh-huh. Wow, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No. You just made me think of something.
Would it expand the ranges of it?
It would. So essentially all this is based off the ends of the airport, the beginning and end of the runway.
So. And have you spoken to the owners of the airport?
We did.
Fairly recently in the spring. We met with the owner and his wife to talk about what their long-term plans are. And this, it's my understanding from that conversation, is that this is really the owner's hobby. And it is not something that he's prepared to relinquish very easily. He does have it listed for sale, but the listing price is... It's a quiet listing, and it is well over market.
Well, I was more thinking more along the lines of, is he planning on any development like a major or bigger airport?
No, I don't believe.
Doesn't sound like it.
Unless a future buyer might be interested in that.
Right, but then we'll deal with that. Okay, that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Tuttle.
Thank you. It's our understanding, based on the owner coming in as well as some other input that's come in, that the council member camp, the runway cannot be expanded because of the wetlands. So
not expanded.
And widened. Either.
And widened.
Either. Okay. So that, as of now, that's what we understood. And so then back to the big picture here is, we do recognize that it was some specific parcels that are mostly impacted by the worst of the restrictions for developing that property. But the whole area that is currently red and polka dotted was previously just red for commercial. And so to avoid doing spot zoning or calling out certain parcels, we thought we would give that flexibility to the whole entire commercial area. So that would be a place for some input from the council as well, because that changes not just the airport area, but the whole of the red. So if that is a direction that everyone's comfortable with, then we'll continue there. But if there are some other solutions that the council may have ideas about, we're open. We just know that those particular parcels are greatly impacted, and there's the scope is very, very narrow. And that is all I had to say.
Thank you. Councilmember Gamble?
Just on that, Bridget, I absolutely support that. I do know that. I remember when we had this conversation previously, the YMCA has property in here that is not developed, that's impacted by this.
Yeah,
when they looked at some of their different feasibility things, so I fully support it. So, I mean, it absolutely, for the totality of property owners in that area, it just makes sense. What I was remembering, Councilmember Camp, which you reminded me of there, is that when the airport previously we were talking about, they were going to grow. They wanted, you know, whether they could have a jet in there or, you know, a smaller.
I remember exactly,
but it was for more of that commercial, you know, charter, you know, type scenario. If you remember at that time, that's when Payne Field conversations were going on, and we actually, as a council, put our support behind Payne Field, did a resolution along with some other cities in the surrounding in support of Payne Field having, you know, flights going into there so that we could have a regional airport, you know, to the north. And I just think, you know, when you consider that in conjunction with Harvey Airfield and then our Hobby Airfield, I feel pretty confident that we're covered from the airport perspective. So that's, it made me remember that we actually had that discussion, and we put our support, we have even a supporting resolution behind the Boeing running Horizon flights out of there. Take the deal.
Thank you. Commissioner Jensen.
Yes. A couple points about this just to keep in mind too is, while we're talking about this polka dot zone, and it might not be something to talk about tonight, but I know the whole airport zone is being given a new tourist commercial zone. This is even before we learned about overlay, talking about, allow things like hotels or motels or bed and breakfasts and restaurants, something that could coexist with the airport. It might be they can't exist because of these overlays. But the whole zone, including the airport, would have that designation. If that changes the value of the property, it might be that in the future another developer comes in and buys the airport saying, I can make this whole thing commercial now. I'm okay with that myself, personally, because suddenly this overlay goes away and all our problems go away. And we're already zoned both over in the airport area, and these polka dot area would now be not polka dots, both commercial and industrial, this hybrid. If the airport did go away, the commercial aspect becomes unrestricted and could then kind of, you know, the market pressures could bring it back more commercial rather than industrial.
and we don't have to do anything about it. We don't have to make a comp plan change to do this because we're keeping it under the commercial designation. But just note that with all the other airport getting this tourist commercial zone, maybe market pressures could change, and maybe the airport does change in the future or go away in the future if expansion is impossible. I don't know, but it is a possibility that that could happen. So that's all.
Thank you. Mr. Swanson, I've got a couple questions. So tell me a little bit about the uses that would be allowed in the commercial industrial zone, the polka dot areas.
It would essentially be any uses that are allowed in the, correct me if I'm wrong, I think this is the vision of the Planning Commission, is any uses that were allowed in the light industrial zone and the commercial zone would be allowed in this zone. It'd be similar to what we currently allow in our, or the current allowed uses in our light industrial zone, where we essentially allow all commercial and all industrial uses in there. And so it would be, a hybrid.
Okay. And why not just do commercial zone? Is it just trying to open up the properties to redevelopment, or?
The commercial zone, because it has such a high density that accompanies with it, it doesn't allow for build out of those vacant parcels or potentially vacant parcels because of the airport overlay zone on top of them. And that was the big problem that we're running into. It's the one that Mr. Etter was specifically speaking to, is when we advised him that his comp plan designation is commercial and at some point in the near future his zoning would be changing to commercial, his response was, I would love to do commercial, however your airport overlay zone won't allow me to do commercial due to its density restrictions.
Okay, so because of the private airport, I only say that it's not FAA funded, which is Harvey Airfield, Payne Field, SeaTac, and so on. The theory here is that to get that one property to redevelop, the thought process here is to allow both commercial and industrial on all of these other polka dotted properties around this node that has high visibility from Highway 2.
The two properties, the one adjacent to Highway 2 and the one just down from that owned by Mr. Welcome, I believe was Planning Commission's intent.
Okay, I'm confused then at the map I'm looking at. I'm seeing, I'm reading the polka dot to include the YMCA property,
mm-hmm.
So that would become potentially industrial. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, I'm backing up. It was the, when you talked about the one property, it was the two properties that are actually vacant for redevelopment.
But you're right, it is the whole all of that.
Okay. I was, when I made the map, was just trying to show the area that the comp plan designates as general commercial.
Okay.
So and as part of the discussion, the parcels would be narrowed down.
Okay. Yeah. So a couple things. One, I know that there was a diesel place over on the north side of Highway 2, opposite the Tractor Supply. I think my preference, and I think that neighborhood's preference, would be to have something that's more commercial or retail in nature, something that people can walk down to that might be able to get coffee or bakery goods or maybe even have a brewery or wine tasting thing or something there, something that's more compatible with that residential neighborhood. So I'd be concerned if the intent of the polka dots there is to expand industrial on the north side of Highway 2, or at least allow that to occur, even though those are newer buildings, I'd be concerned about the expansion of that northward. Is that something that the polka dots would allow if done the way the polka dots are shown?
Correct. It would allow both commercial and industrial uses.
Okay. So some feedback from me, I myself would prefer, and you know, this would be up to Planning Commission to recommend to Council and Council ultimately to approve. My preference would be to not see the industrial expand to the north side of Highway 2, that it be commercial on the north side of Highway 2, and it's not encumbered by that as much by that that number 2 airport overlay zone anyway. Would there be any problem with having that be more retail?
It is in the 3. It's in the wing of that 3, so there are some density restrictions on it. However, you hit the nail on the head where they are existing buildings.
Mm-hmm.
New businesses going in that essentially increase the density, we may run into some issues there.
Okay.
I have a response.
Understood. I'll come to you, Mr. Commissioner, just a second. So then on the south side, Ms. Knight had just asked me the question just to follow up. Could we put retail in the rest of the polka dot on the south side? And you're telling me that it's because the occupancy would be too great to have retail?
So, yeah, it's you're running into two conflicting, essentially, regulations. You have the zoning code that would allow retail and allow commercial, and then you have the airport overlay that restricts the density. And so anytime you go to look at a commercial or restaurant use and take a high one, you know, fast food, we had the old McDonald's there. Under today's code with the airport overlay, that wouldn't be allowed just due to the density that's associated with the fast food restaurant, not only with the employees, but also the customers going in there. And so it's essentially an occupant load is what we're looking at, as where you have a warehouse which has a very low occupant load.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what Planning Commission has been wrestling with, is how do we make this work given the restrictions of the airport overlay zone that we can't make go away.
Okay. The hard thing here is that I'm looking at Lake Tai, which is sort of a centerpiece of Monroe and certainly of the west side of Monroe, and the potential of having an industrial use redevelop on the north end of that lake. You've got the trail that's going through those properties. We've also talked a little bit on the Parks Advisory Board and part of connecting trails to the city of Snohomish, maybe having a trailhead at this location. So, you know, there's some difficulty, and I do understand the private airfield and everything, and I go to Commissioner Jensen's point. I too would appreciate the opportunity for this privately owned land to be able to become a different use, something that wouldn't have this impact on adjoining properties, regulations that didn't exist when it went into effect, but at the same time have a redevelopment that might have some synergy with the fairgrounds and bring more interest. As an example, being something like a Grey Wolf Lodge or something that would have a lodging component and a recreational component that would help bring more year-round stays and things to our community. I think that there'd be a nice synergy for something like that. Okay, well, those are my thoughts. My preference would be to not see industrial allowed on the north side of Highway 2, even though those are newer buildings. I think that there's an interest in having more commercial at this node in general, and the polka dots, I would try to restrict those to as minimal as possible, even if it might appear to be spot zoning. I think the nexus that I would use would just be, I don't know, but I would be concerned about allowing more industrial at that node. Those are my thoughts. Commissioner Jensen, and I'm sorry, Ms. Knight, do you have anything further to add?
I don't.
Okay.
Thank you.
Commissioner Jensen.
Okay. Regarding the north side of 2, what's not been discussed, it was mentioned to us at one point, because of the hillside, the planes don't turn that way. They don't turn north. So the two northern threes, those wedges, don't actually exist for us.
Okay.
We can not, they are not enforced because the planes don't use that traffic pattern. So on the north side, it can be left commercial, and they don't have the same encumbrances of the overlay, except maybe where zone 1 just kind of touches that one, but I think that's already developed out, the AMPM, so probably wouldn't be an issue. I mean, it's probably legal non-conforming right now because of that overlay.
Right.
But the rest of it, that northern three wedge shouldn't really be on there because it doesn't apply to this particular airport.
Okay, so as a follow-up, is that something that needs to be edited in our regulations to adjust that wedge number 3 on the north side?
Yeah, we haven't finished with the airport regulations
Understood.
Yet either.
Thank you for pointing that out, Commissioner. Anything further?
No.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Stanger.
Yeah, I agree. I think north of Highway 2, I think we should just based off of what's there right now, and with more housing going up there, I think we want to try to get as much retail in there as possible. So if we can do anything, because it is on the hill and they don't turn, and whatever we can do, I think we should do that. South of Highway 2, that's pretty much right in that impacted area. So I don't know if there's anything we can do there. I mean, mm-hmm. even if we did zone it to something that would allow more retail, the overlay would trump it. So this is what it's doing here. So I guess we could still do that, mm-hmm. but then that would impact some eyesore properties and things we want to, you know, to help to.
An eyesore.
Yeah. So I don't know. So I don't know. I guess the question is how much more can we, how much more of this can we reduce without spot getting hit with spot zoning? So
understood.
Because I agree with that too. You know, we want Lake Tye to be the same. We want it to be as much retail, consumer friendly, family friendly. I would want to see a lot of industrial there. But,
all right. So. Okay. Thank you. Chair Tuttle.
Thank you. Rewinding just a little bit then. Yeah, none of us, this wasn't the preference.
Yeah.
This was a solution to an issue. So what we were looking at on our comprehensive plan map that was adopted by the council was this entire area is all the polka dotted, before it was polka dotted, was all red.
Yeah.
And so it's all the same. I don't know how we would want to break that up. I honestly don't know why north of the highway and south of the highway became the same zone, but that's what it is right now, unless we want to break that into smaller zones and then isolate those areas that are impacted. But I would definitely, I don't know if that's something that Director Swanson can parse out for us, but if that would be the preferred direction from us as well, that it would be two separate areas treated separately. But that was kind of where we landed in that end to try to make it consistent. So
I understand.
So the input and direction is definitely appreciated, and then I don't know where to go from there as far as where the council and you, the mayor, feel about just isolating those few properties that are in the number two zone, or where should we go?
Yeah, so just some thoughts. Again, it's a recommendation that Planning Commission will want to come forward with. The one thing that I would acknowledge is this, is that we're trying to fix a problem for one property, right? The discussion we're having on the zoning here appears to be because of one property that has fallen into significant disrepair, where I'm aware of other things beyond tagging associated with the property. Just because we changed the zoning doesn't necessarily mean that the non-compliances that are occurring there today will suddenly go away. It doesn't necessarily mean that by making it available to any kind of development that the property will suddenly sell and the structures will be taken away and whatnot. So that's something to think about. As a former planner, have been doing that for over 15 years now, would be concerned about zoning an area of town to try to solve one problem on one property. And so that's what I'm trying to bring up here. I think the area was probably zoned for commercial with a vision in mind of this being a node in the future where we would have retail and things like that. And so I would ask that while there has been a concern about one property, that we take a look at the other eight or more properties there and think about what our overall vision is. And I think that that's part of what I've been raising relative to the neighborhood that I live in. And I pass by these properties every day, and I see people walking past the properties every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking of that long term of what does Lake Tye look like in the future? What does this intersection look like in the future? What do the residents in the area have to walk to versus having an industrial something right next door? So those are the things that I would share with you, and I don't know where that leaves the Planning Commission or the Council ultimately to deal with that one cinder block Eastside Masonry property, but those are the things that I'm thinking of from a long-haul strategic view. Councilmember Gamble?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying is that you feel it's one property right now, because that's what the topic of discussion is today.
Yeah.
What I would say is this is not new from the standing. There are other properties. This didn't come up because of that property before.
Yeah.
So remember, we have the YMCA property that's in there that I even remember. I think actually when Council Member Cutterback was still the executive at that branch, when she was, obviously she had to recuse herself on, anything from a council perspective there, but she very much voiced her opinion from a Y perspective that they are very much interested in, laxing or whatever we can do to make it easier for them to even develop that land. So I don't view it as one. I do agree with you that, hey, the north would be great. I'm with
Commissioner Tuttle there. It's that I get what you guys were doing and not wanting to spot zone, and I did it and try to account for, you know, all the stuff that's in the overlay zone period. So if there is a way that we could split it, that would be my preference.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's been, how long has that thing been sitting vacant?
Right? Long time.
And then we've got the Y property that's been there for a long time, and I know the last time that they had plans for that, really can't get off the ground because of some of the overlay stuff that we have or the zoning stuff. So,
yeah. Okay.
I still think it. The more flexibility we have there, the better.
Okay. Councilmember Hanford.
For the second time, I can do it.
Sounds good. All right. Anything further on the topic? Chair Tuttle, do you have any further questions for the council on this topic?
I don't feel like I have a clear direction. So what would you all like to see us go forward with? Or do you just want us to send forth a recommendation and then have you send it back with input? Is that the best course of action here?
Yeah, I think what I hear is that the council, who's voiced their interest here, is sharing an interest in having a more liberal approach, not in a political sense, but allowing more uses in those properties. And at the end of the day, it's up to Planning Commission to weigh the input that you heard from council. You don't work for the council or for me. You're a separate body.
Mm-hmm.
Think through the comments that you've heard here, and the council and I certainly look forward to what you come up with for a recommendation.
All right.
But what I'm hearing is a direction for a more liberal approach with more uses.
Okay.
Thank
you.
You're welcome. Next topic.
Unless you have, I mean, again, we have a lot of information in the packet. If there's specific questions that you would like myself or any of the planning commissioners to address or add, we are more than happy to do so. So if there's anything additional. I do want to note this planning commission has just been absolutely amazing through this process. They've been doing, you know, 4 meetings a month, and they would do 5 if they were asked. So, I mean, it's a great group, an interactive group. So they're really putting everything into this code update. So
thank you. Just a real quick question, what's your timeline for bringing this back before the council?
End of the year. We would love September, but we're pushing it.
Okay. All right. Anything further? All right. And planning commissioners, I really appreciate the work that you're doing also. You know, some of you were here for the comp plan update, and you got to have that opportunity to really dream. This is your opportunity now to actually make it happen from a regulatory standpoint. I think we talked a little bit about how you do all these dreamy things with the comp plan and whatnot, and it's not all the time that you actually get to get into the regulations, and that's what you're doing here. So I really appreciate this total rewrite of our development regulations. I think it's going to make things a lot easier for us to administer from the administrative standpoint. It's going to make things more predictable, I think, for applicants and developers. And let's face it, now you're actually putting in the rules to help realize that vision that you came up with. And I appreciate your extra work you've been putting in to make this happen on the timeline. So thank you, everybody.
Anything
further from council members? Anything further from planning commissioners?
Yes, we appreciate the two joint meetings a year. That was something that was important to me, and I'm thankful that we've managed to. I don't know who's making sure that it happens, but I'm glad that we're making sure that it happens. So thank you.
All right. So we're done with that part of our meeting, and I understand if planning commissioners want to up and leave. We're going to move on to budget items now, I think.
Someone's going to take my spot.
Oops, this is next week's agenda. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and give folks about 30 seconds here to relocate.
Becky, you're fine.
Yep, she's on the You can certainly stay.
No, I was going to stay.
Oh, okay. Thank you for.
Yeah, so if you want, you know,
Becky, did you want to sit over here? Okay, Bridget, you can stay here.
No, I'm good.
Okay.
Oh, I'll keep these.
Okay, okay.
I'm proctoring your session on Thursday. You better do this. You never called the auditor, so I bumped you.
I don't know.
You're welcome to sit there.
You're fine. No, you're fine up here. Yep.
You have to name tag on so bad.
Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Pretty easy going.
5. Okay, Becky, are you ready to continue with the meeting?
Sure.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and move on to discussion item number 2. This is AB 18-175, property tax revenue. Ms. Hassert.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So, as part of any budget process, one of the things that we talk about is revenues and our various revenue streams. And in fact, that's important enough that it's also required by RCW that we hold a public hearing to talk about what revenues and how we projected our revenues that we are forecasting into our budget. So having said that, one of the larger revenue streams for any city is property taxes. So tonight's discussion is meant to be more just kind of educational for you. In the short time that I've been here, I've heard a lot of different comments about property taxes, which kind of indicates to me there's still a lot of misunderstanding about how it works, especially in a time where assessed values are going up and what that could mean for a homeowner here in town. If council were to make specific decisions with regards to property taxes. So with that, what I thought I would do tonight is start with talking about the 1% that is allowed by law that council can take without a vote of the people. I'm using 1% in a general fashion in that we all know that with referendum 47, any city with a population over 10,000 population, you're limited to 1% or the implicit price deflator, whichever is less. More often than not, that IPD is more than 1%, so that's why from a general standpoint, we're talking about 1%, just to make that clear. So having said that, in the agenda bill, in your packet, if you go to page 3 of 12, you will see a spreadsheet here where we try and show the relationship between assessed value and what happens if a council were to take that 1%. So for example, we know for sure what our assessed value was for 2018. So in the very first column there, that very first number, that $2.255 billion, that is our 2018 assessed value. We have heard from the Snohomish Auditor's Office, Assessor's Office, that before consideration of new construction, assessed values out here in Monroe are going to go up to $2.552 billion. That represents a 13.17% increase in assessed values. Now, that doesn't mean every property in town went up that much. Some went up a little bit less, some went up a little bit more. It's reflective of what the market's doing right now. So you can see then, if you carry over to where it says current levy, this year our levy was certified at $2.674 million. If the council were to adopt and take its allowed 1%, the new levy, again, this is all before consideration of new construction, becomes $2.701 million. That $2.701 million, as far as the formula goes for property taxes, is what you use and you divide by the new assessed value. You will see that there's an actual inverse relationship between how much assessed value goes up for the entire city and what happens to the rate per thousand that is now allowed to be charged against the properties in the city. Okay? Now, I wanted to use somewhat of a real-world example here. So you will see then over on the right-hand side of that spreadsheet, I grabbed a property here in Monroe that I'm somewhat familiar with, and according to the assessor's office for 2018, that property is worth $389,500. Okay. Based on the formula, for 2018, that property is paying the city $461.79 in its property taxes. Carrying this out for 2019, the assessor has already has on its website what the 19 assessed value is going to be for this property. That's what you see there with the $433,200. If the city were to take the 1%, what you see is this particular property's assessed value actually goes, or amount that it would pay to the city next year actually goes down. Again, that's a function of the fact that that rate per thousand went down. This property, its assessed value increased less than the average for the city. So its assessed value went up 11.22%. I know I'm throwing a lot of numbers at you. If the property had gone up the average 13.17%, then the property tax would have had that 1% increase. So you would have seen an additional $4.61 in that property tax bill for that property. Again, that would have only gone up the 1%. It would not go up that 13.17% that the assessed value went up because of that inverse relationship between assessed value and the rate per thousand. So that was one misunderstanding I've heard mentioned in my time here at Monroe's that I wanted to kind of try and highlight for you guys tonight. Questions?
So just to state it a different way, if the 1%, if the council would not approve the 1% increase in this example, the property taxes would still go down. They would just go down by more than $3.40.
Correct. That's the bottom set of numbers there.
Right.
On this page.
Right. If the property had gone up by that average assessed value for the entire city by the 15%, you said?
13.7.
Then this property owner would actually see an increase of roughly $4.50 per year.
Yes, $4.61, yeah.
Right, okay.
So the inverse, as you were talking about, that second set of numbers on this particular example here, if the city does not take the 1%, then what you're looking at is this person's property taxes towards the city actually goes down even more. But the amount then that you didn't take, the $4.54, is what gets baked. So that's an authority then that gets put aside that you can take at a later date. So you don't lose that authority to take that 1%. You're just choosing not to take it now. In a sense, you're deferring it. It's not money that goes into an account somewhere because the taxes won't get collected. The only time that tax gets collected is if the city chooses to tap into that baked capacity. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, here's another misconception that I've heard. The city has actually used some of its prior bank capacity. It did it as recently as for fiscal year 2017. Back in fiscal year 2017, the city used $484,312 of its bank capacity at that time, and that helped to buy you guys a parks maintenance supervisor, part-time permit tech, and a city accountant. Now, one of the decisions that was made with that city accountant during 2018 was instead of filling that position, we did the part-time permit tech and made that full-time because of the overwhelming volumes that community development's dealing with right now. With the UDR update and everything else, it just felt like that need was a little greater. But I wanted to clarify, we have used bank capacity. And in fact, I put a graph together for you for another reason, but I think it is good to take a look at. On page 10 of 12, you will see a graph here that shows the historical rates per thousand that our citizens have been paying with regards to property taxes. Our maximum, you can never go above the maximum allowed, which is $1.60 per thousand. Yep.
cost alone.
Okay. Yep. 2013, our rate per thousand was around $1.46. As assessed values went up, you see that rate per thousand go down. Remember, we have that inverse relationship. So in 14, you're banking that 1%, you drop to $1.36. Then you drop to $1.23, $1.15. You see it jump up again to $1.29 there in 17. That is a function of the fact that you used $484,000 in bank capacity. But if you notice, the $1.29 is still not as much as your recent high, which was that $1.46, and that's what this graph is showing you here. Okay. And then the $1.05 that you see there for 2019, that reflects the projections that we make that I just took you through on the other appendix. Okay. Another break for questions.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Kemp?
Thank you. All right, I'm sorry. I don't understand the inverse relationship between rate per thousand. Could you zip through that one?
Sure. This might help. And I'm going to try and do this in my head, so please forgive me. Have a whiteboard.
Make certain you can erase that real quick.
No, I'll do it. Be more fun.
Okay, we're good.
It's a fire escape.
So, if we have 1 billion, say our assessed value is 1 billion, and our collection was $100,000 for the year.
Okay.
Okay. If you increase this to 101,000, so that's 1%, mm-hmm. the assessed value goes up 10%, so that's 10 million. So now I've got 1,000,000. At this point here, your rate per thousand was a dollar, right? The math, let me get my calculator here, is you take that 101,000 and you divide this. You divide this by 1,000 to start with, and then you divide this by this.
And
in this case, you're going to get, hang on a second, I think I did my math wrong. But
because you're limited to the 1%
right.
every time, and you're dividing it into a higher assessed value, right. the levy rate always falls down.
So that's why the rate is going down, however the amount is going up.
Right, and it's because of the limitation of the 1%.
Got it.
Yes.
Okay.
Right?
And that's
so
that inverse
because you can only collect 101%, and this has grown more than 1%, mm-hmm. in order to keep collecting at only that 1%, your levy rate has to fall.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
You could think about it the other way, too. You can say you have to multiply your levy rate by this amount to only get 101%, right?
Got
and
it.
So if your levy rate stayed the same, you'd collect more than 1%. So you have to keep dropping your levy rate every time your assessed value goes up in order to keep collecting only 1%.
Okay.
Does that make sense to you,
it
too?
Does.
And reversing that math? Yeah.
It does. Okay, the other point is you have your special house.
It is a house. Special house. Thank
okay.
you very much.
I don't know whose house it is, and I'm not even going to try and get it. So this particular house only increased in value by 11.22, and
right.
the average is 13.17. Doesn't that average out?
Yes.
So
people
in effect, we're going to get more money coming in.
You'll have that 1% more coming in the aggregate.
Yes.
Yes. That then gets spread out on all the properties within
right.
town.
So some houses are going to go up.
Correct.
More in their taxes, and some, like this one, actually
will go down a little bit, yes.
Yeah, okay. All right.
So what's interesting about that is I did not know that that was how it was going to play out until I did the numbers
okay.
on this particular house. So you are right. If someone's house went up assessed value-wise more than 13.17%,
mm-hmm.
they will see an increase in their property tax.
So if we took
but
that.
But it's still not going to be a significant amount. It's not going to be 13% increase, is the point.
Okay, but then that implies that somebody's house is going up, let's say 15%. I'm just throwing that
okay.
out there, right? And somebody else's house will go up 8%.
Mm-hmm.
That means, in effect, they would get hit with a 1% more, let's say a 16% tax increase.
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
And that's why I'm saying let's do the math.
Let's do the math.
So let's take the same house, the 389,500, and say it does increase by 15%.
Okay.
So now it's worth 447,925.
Right.
Okay. Your rate here is still the $1.05. Okay, that's not going to change.
Because of the inverse relationship to
correct.
The current level. Got it.
So if I take that 447.925 times $1.05815, I'm going to get $473.97.
So it's kind of 3.97 minus 461.79.
So yeah, $12.18.
Okay.
So again, it's not a significant amount, but yes, it goes up more than 1%. That actually looks like it's about 3%. I mean, I can do the math here real quick.
Mapping us out.
Sorry.
What's that?
3 times 4. Yeah, it's about
3%. Yeah, it's about 3%. So it's not 15%. So I'm dividing the wrong amount. And that's what I mean by that inverse relationship.
Right.
So if the assessed, again, our average assessed value is going up 13.17%, that does not mean property tax bills are going to go up that much.
Right. Okay.
And that's what I was trying to educate on tonight.
And you did a good job. I actually understood that.
Well, and it helps the chief understand too.
So that's it for me. Thanks.
Okay, you're welcome. Any other questions?
Yeah, so you clarify, all things being equal, so only talking about the city portion of the property
right.
tax, if there is no new construction and if there is no change in the property tax, meaning that council doesn't authorize a 1% increase or bank capacity, so assuming no property tax increase, assuming no new construction, if assessed values go up from one year to the next, we still collect the same amount of money in property tax.
Correct.
People often think that if your assessed value goes up, that you pay more money in property tax the next year.
And
that is not the case. The size of the pie stays the same unless there is new construction or unless you raise property taxes.
Can we clarify this one?
Please, yeah.
So, what the mayor is saying is that our pie, in this case, is 2.674 million.
Right.
Okay. If the assessed value did not change,
right.
or I should, if the assessed value changed, it went up 13.17.
Right.
If this house had gone up 13.17,
right.
the math, and you did not take the 1%, remember, the
right.
rate per thousand changes,
reduces.
This house would still only pay $461.79.
Okay. So you're saying you're pulling in the same amount of money no matter what the assessed value of the house is as it goes up.
When right. people come in and say, my assessed value went up, and therefore I'm paying more in taxes, that's not the case.
Not if it went up the same as what the average was.
Over the average, then.
There's going to be a little bit of an adjustment, yes, but the overall collection from the city does not change.
Okay, that's fine. Some people will still be paying more money, but on average, it will stay the same for the city overall.
Right.
Okay. And I'm okay. sorry, you have the floor.
No. It's good. It is a conversation, and things get so technical on this, it's easy to say no new taxes. I think we were talking about that in the committee. It's just important for us to understand as policymakers what the math actually means. And one of the things that we were talking about in committee was just how you've got the school district, the fire district, and so on. They go out to special votes during different times of the year. The property taxes go up, and we're held at a different standard at City Hall. We don't increase taxes, whereas everybody else is increasing taxes. At the end of the day, you get that tax bill at home, you're paying more than you did last year, and what you're not realizing is that that money's going to PD, I'm sorry, that money's going to the fire district, it's going to the library district, it's going to the school district, it's not going to your police department, it's not going to your parks department, it's not going to those things here locally. So that was just part of the conversation that we had, and part of...
And where we're going tonight.
Yeah. Yes.
Yield, I just want to make sure that I'm clear on this. So without new construction, that, or with new construction, that is increasing your rates for the city. So if we just...
No.
No.
And that was what I was going to bring up next.
Then I'll shut up.
So, if I may?
Please.
Okay.
Wait, you had asked any questions. Are there any other questions before she continues? Okay, go ahead.
Okay. So one of the reasons that we want to make sure that you guys understand the inverse relationship when assessed values are going up, if you don't take the 1%, we want to illustrate what that happens, what that kind of effect that has up with new construction. So again, getting back to the point that the mayor is making, if you don't take the 1% and there had been no new construction, then all we're going to receive the next year in property taxes is the same amount we received the prior year. So the only growth that we are getting in our property tax revenue year over year has been the effects of new construction.
Yeah.
So the way that works is, as you can see with this example again, in 19, the assessed value went up. It created a new rate per thousand, which went down because of that inverse relationship. Now that is the rate per thousand that I apply to the new construction.
Okay,
so if there had been $20 million of new construction, without the 1%, I'm applying $1.04 towards that new construction.
Why $1.04?
Because that is the resultant rate by not taking the 1%. So you're leaving a penny on the table.
Oh, there it is. Okay.
Yeah. So basically then what you've done by not taking that 1% is you've left a penny per $1,000 of new construction on the table. It may not sound like much, but over the years, for all the years that we have not been taking that 1%, it has a compounding effect on what happens against the new construction. And one of the points that I would like to make is when you don't take the 1%, that gets baked. That's there for, that you can take later, so you don't lose that. But you do lose that penny per thousand on new construction, that does not get baked. That's lost opportunity right there. So one of the attachments that I put in here, and it's page 12 of 12, it looks like this. So it should be towards the very end. There you go. This actually shows, and I think I had it right, the page right prior to it is the actual numbers. If I went back and started in 2011 and say 11 had been the first year we didn't take a 1%, then you left $60 on the table. The next year, that became 83. You see how that grew each year. That had you been taking the 1%, that's what we could have received. That's the difference of what we didn't. So from 2011 and 2018, there was $12,500 that's just lost. That does not get banked. The reality is that number is actually bigger because we have not been taking that 1% for much further back. So again, it grows because it's that 1% and then the 1% the next year on top of it, etc. So again, I'm not saying that it's good or bad. I just want you to be aware of the implications.
Questions? I don't see any.
Okay. So, now, having said that, the other thing that we wanted to talk about in this agenda bill is that, as you know, the city had the Economic Development Advisory Board that made some recommendations with regards to what they hope to see in the 2019 budget.
Before you move on to that, mm-hmm. So the McCleary decision.
Oh, yes, thank you. Thank you for bringing me back. McCleary, as everybody knows, the state, in its last budget cycle, has finally taken the steps legislatively to what they have taken to the courts to say that they have fully funded McCleary. And the way that they have done that is, to put it in simplest terms, is they upped how much they are collecting that they're doing at the state level, that then they will disperse to all the various school districts within the state. So ideally, they're keeping them all on level footing. In exchange, so people's property taxes saw a big bump for fiscal year 18 because of that, because they didn't make an adjustment at the local level yet for the local school, what they call their, I had it in the agenda bill, their O&M levy. And this doesn't talk about their capital levy that was approved by voters. Part of that was to give school districts a fiscal year to adjust to the new funding model. Beginning in 2019, local school districts, their O&M levies are going to be capped at $1.50 per thousand. Monroe schools were actually at over $3 per thousand. So where our property tax or our property owners saw that bump for 18, they're going to see a decrease then for 19. And that there's a press release. I included the press release from the county that showed the impacts to the various school districts.
You're going to cut it in half.
Pretty close, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so the reason why we brought that up is that there was a misunderstanding that the McCleary money, if you will, that occurred in 2018 was carrying over to 2019. That's not the case. It's not carrying into 2019.
19 is the year that all the school districts will see that decrease.
There's a nice chart that Ms. Hasser put together that shows a particular household in Monroe and the impacts of the decrease in school collection on O&M levies and what that does to that tax bill.
So it's page 9 of 12?
Or 180 of 224, if you can have the red numbers.
Oh, I didn't have the red numbers in the one printed.
180 of 226, maybe?
I don't yes. Have it. Yes, 180 of 226,
like
I think.
This one? There must have been a
different
fraction.
181 of 226. You know, by the time we figure this out, we'll be in
back
in chambers.
We'll be out of time.
I know, I'm just not having my laptop and being able to talk to you. So you look at this one. So you'll see on here the school's O&M. So this is the actual tax bill for this particular property. So for 2018, their total tax bill for all organizations was over $4,600. Mm-hmm. There's the $461 at the very top that goes to the city of Monroe. Another point that I want to show here is that there's also people who think that for some reason the city gets the entire $4,600. We don't. In this case, it's a little less than 10% of the overall tax bill comes to the city. Okay. Having said that, the school district, the school O&M levy is $1,169. Assuming that, or actually, this is, there's no assumption here, that county's already said what the 19 assessed value is going to be. That's going to drop to $1.50. That particular portion of this property tax bill is dropping significantly. It's almost, what is that, $500 and something? So that's the implications of what's happening with McCleary. Okay. Now, the other thing with regards to the rest of these numbers, we'll get to here in a minute with the city portion. So if you ignore the city portion, I made some assumptions here in that the fire district would go ahead and take their full 1% and that they're still under their $1.50 per thousand. I made the assumption that the hospital district, the library, the county, and the state would all take their 1%. So I went ahead and just increased those dollar amounts by 1%, even though we know there's an inverse relationship, blah, 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 but I wanted to be conservative, show worst case scenario. For the capital levies, usually what happens with capital that's been voted is that as assessed values go up, since it's a finite amount they're collecting every year for their bond payments, that amount usually goes down as the years progress. I kept them level, again, to try and show worst case scenario. So getting back to the city portion of this, again, as I mentioned, we had the EDAB who made some recommendations, and then part of that is they made recommendations with regards to funding. One of the recommendations being possibly using $200,000 of the bank capacity that we have. We've also been talking to the Parks Board about some potential with regards to staffing over there, and part of their recommendation is possibly using some of the bank capacity. Again, that still has to be vetted through the budget process, so that may or may not come before you. But I wanted to show what that would look like for you if that were indeed the case. So again, if you go back to, well, the big spreadsheet, and I went ahead and printed big ones to make it easier to see than what the packets have. I want to send those down that way. And give it, yes, there is. There's actually enough for the audience too if they want. I'm going to go through this one real quick. The top section, so rows 7 through 13, assumes a minimal amount of increase in assessed value every year. It assumes that you are not taking your 1%, that any growth in property tax is due to new construction. So it shows what happens to the levy rate each year. Okay, and that's column G, is the new levy rate each year. The second group of numbers from rows 17 through 23, that is assuming that you've tapped into $200,000 of the bank capacity. It shows what happens to your rate per thousand. And then the bottom set of numbers is if you tap in for $450,000 of your bank capacity, you see what that does to the rate per thousand. Again, I'm showing at different price points for houses what that means for the city's portion of taxes then against that house. So that's just taking you through that really, really quick. Again, a bigger spreadsheet of the one we were just looking at.
That's pretty
for
good.
That particular house that we've been playing with.
So as you're going through this, this is a one, this will be in 2019 with no bank.
2019 would be when you take the bank capacity,
right,
that then resets what you're looking at each year for collection.
But these wouldn't have any changes. They would all be no bank, right? After 2019 in this column?
Correct. You're not taking more bank.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So, again, worst case scenario, back at that house. If we use the levy rate that is resultant by taking the $450,000 in bank capacity on this particular house, you can see that the rate that would be paid to the city of Monroe goes from $461 to $530. But when you take that in conjunction with all the other organizations and the McCleary decision impacts, the tax bill for this particular property actually goes down over $400. So again, just illustrative purposes, we're not making any recommendations one way or the other. I just want to show the most conservative, this is what the implication would be. Okay. Everybody with me?
I'm sorry, Councilmember Scarborough.
So in conversations with the school district, how do they plan to recoup this $500 and something or $500?
Well, the theory is that
they
receive it from the state now. Because remember, in 18, the state's portion of the property tax bill went up for that amount that they're now going to be funding to the schools. So they in some ways, yeah, in 2018, they were doubling up because they were still collecting their full O&M also.
Thanks. Just like the lottery is supposed to do.
Well, I said in theory.
Okay. Any other questions on that? All right. Ms. Esser?
So that pretty much is the presentation. We also made this presentation to the finance committee, but this was specific to with regards to property taxes. Again, we wanted to address some of what I've been hearing out there, the misconception about what happens when assessed values go up that much, what happens if you do or don't take that 1%, I also wanted you guys to just be aware of what type of compounding that has on lost opportunity with regards to new construction. Just as another point to maybe throw out there, our new construction for 2018 was over $74 million. So as you can imagine, a couple of pennies on $74 million can add up. So it's just something to consider. Again, I would go back to the spreadsheet here, or the graph here. You're page 182 of 226. So back where I was showing the impact of what had happened in 17 by taking that bag capacity, you see here in the orange, that is if you took the 200,000. The gray is the estimates if you take 450,000 of the bank capacity. And even at 450 of a rate, $1.22 per thousand, it's still less than what it was in 17, and significantly still less than what it was back in 2013.
Okay, any questions?
I know it's a lot to absorb. I live this stuff, so.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and move on to the next topic. This is AB 18-177, Discussion Memorandum of Understanding with Forterra for Land Acquisition to Acquire Open Space on behalf of the City. Ms. Knight.
Thank you. The City has been working to secure five parcels, about 43 acres, commonly known as the East Monroe property. We've been to Council a couple of times to talk about grant applications. We actually received word that we were successful in securing $500,000 towards the property purchase from Snohomish Conservation Futures, so that's good news. We did our presentations to the Recreation and Conservation Office last week. We have two grants in, looking to secure another $1 million in funding, $500,000 from the WWRP Urban Wildlife Fund, and then another $500,000 in land and water conservation futures funding. So we are well on our way to try and secure funding to purchase the properties. We had reached out to Forterra, which is a private nonprofit kind of dedicated towards buying and preserving open space and farmland, and we're asking them to support us in our Conservation Futures grant by providing a letter of support for that grant application. And they got interested enough in the property that they actually called us back and wanted to know if there was an opportunity to sit down and talk both with the city and with the property owner about coming together around an acquisition process. And so the memorandum of understanding that you have in front of you today is kind of their standard template for providing what they call bridge funding to purchase a property. So under the terms of the memorandum of understanding, what Forterra would do would be to negotiate a purchase and sale agreement with the property owner based upon an appraised value. If it's more than appraised value, then they'll come back and get the city's permission to continue with those negotiations. In return, though, for that work on behalf of the city then commits to continuing to work to secure funding to repurchase the property then Forterra within a 3-year time period. And there are some additional expenses that are included in the memorandum of understanding that I wanted to also go through with the City Council so you could really see kind of the bigger picture perspective of what it would cost if we were to enter into an agreement with Forterra. And so if you take a look at the table that is on page, well, I think in probably your agenda pack would be 219 or 220, excuse me, of 226. There's this nice table at the bottom of that page.
In red.
In red, thank you. And it outlines then the additional terms of the memorandum and the costs associated with those terms. And the way that I broke it down in Table 1 is into two sections. The first section outlines what would typically be required for a purchase and sale agreement if the city were to pursue that. So these are costs that the city would need to pay regardless of who was involved in the transaction.
The second set of costs are costs that are specific to this memorandum of understanding, and those are the costs that I'm going to talk specifically about. So the first one is the lease cost. So under the terms of the MOU, what Forterra proposes to do is to invoice the city a flat fee based on staff time, not to exceed $10,000. So this is for their internal work to negotiate the purchase and sale agreement with the property owner and then continue to work with the city post-purchase to do the repurchase at some time in the future. There's also the closing costs, and because this is a purchase and sale agreement between Forterra and the property owner, and then a second purchase between the city and Forterra to repurchase the property, the city would be responsible for paying both of those closing costs, and we anticipate those to run somewhere between $6,000 and $10,000. The appraisal. So the property owner has done an appraisal, and the city is currently working with Forterra to find out whether or not the grant applications that we have in would allow us just to do an appraisal review as opposed to having to go out and do a second full appraisal. But if we have to do a full appraisal, that would be between $7,500 and $15,000. And again, keep in mind that this is a negotiation between Forterra and the property owner and that there's a firewall, so the city has no engagement in those negotiations whatsoever. But we're the ones who are going to be paying for the cost in order to close the purchase and sale agreement. So we would be responsible for paying then for that appraisal or the appraisal review. In some cases, the grant applications that we're applying for require us to do both an appraisal and an appraisal review, and so in that case, we'd have to pay for both of those. So it's basically two appraisals. The first appraiser comes out and does an appraisal, and then there's somebody who comes out to make sure that that appraisal actually meets the requirements for the grants. So the third item that we have is an environmental assessment. And again, in my experience in purchasing property, this is something that a purchaser would normally do as part of due diligence. And so you would always want an assessment as to whether or not there are any hidden environmental impacts that might, or contaminants that might be on the property. So you want to make sure that there aren't any liabilities out there that you're unaware of. In the couple of purchases that I've done, we actually did find an indication, for example, of an underground storage tank. And so there was a phase two environmental assessment that was done in order to actually remove that storage tank from the property. And then you're cleared again to continue to purchase. So in this case, I included both the environmental assessment, the initial assessment, and the phase two, just in case we needed to do one of those as well. And that's estimated to be anywhere between $5,000 and $7,500 for each of those. And the city would need to do that in either case. And then the last item that we have are the interest payments. So Forterra is either going to do some internal borrowing or they're going to go out into the marketplace and borrow money in order to purchase the property. And the city is going to be responsible then for those interest payments, so that's prime plus 0.25%. And depending, again, on what the property acquisition price is, we're estimating that that would be anywhere from $110,000 to $300,000. So, again, that's really based upon purchase price. So you can see all of those expenses are outlined in Table 1 with the low-cost estimate and the high-cost estimate to kind of give you some bookends as to what ultimately it would cost the city if Forterra were to enter into an agreement with us in order to negotiate a purchase and sale with the property owner. So at this point, I'm available to answer any questions about this proposal.
Thank you. Councilmember Camp.
Thank you. Remind me, I can't remember what an opportunity fee is.
The opportunity fee is the charge that Forterra has to actually work the deal, and their time and expense outside of the staffing costs. So this is actually how their business model works, is they charge this opportunity cost in order to provide funding in order to purchase additional properties.
Yeah, I thought it was something like that.
So that's in lieu of a commission, right?
That's a great way to put it.
So a way to think about that is it's in lieu of a commission.
I'm sorry, one more time?
In lieu of a commission, if you were to think about private sector.
Yeah. That's a great way to think about it.
Okay, let's talk about the interest payment again. So the way this is structured, the Forterra is going to negotiate and do the purchase while we're trying to get finances in order to do our portion of the purchase.
In order to repay Forterra. for the cost of the acquisition.
Okay, well, that's what I'm trying to say. So Forterra is going to make the purchase while we're trying to get the money to...
Yes.
Turn around and buy it from Forterra.
Okay. And is there a time limit on that?
So the way that the agreement is currently written is it's 3 years, which allows for the grant funding cycle that we're currently in, plus the grant funding cycle that'll be in 2020.
Okay.
The agreement does allow for an extension if both parties agree.
Okay.
And so in talking to representatives from Forterra, my feeling is that as long as we're working towards purchasing the property, they're comfortable with extending.
So in the event, let's say in 3 years it rolls out, you've got $500,000 in finance or funds right now, and I have to be a pessimist, let's say you can't do it in 3 years and they choose not to extend, that means we're on the hook to pay off the balance.
So what they do in that case then is they would, the way that the agreement is written is they would go back out to the marketplace, they would sell the property for what it's worth, and then the city would be responsible for the difference.
Okay. And based on this, the non-contingent money is, I'm guessing, or estimating between $25,000 to $35,000 out of pocket, right?
So when you say non-contingent?
You've got contingent on acquisition. No.
I'm
assuming
right.
that we have to pay that regardless, right? Well, unless I'm misreading this.
Yes. So these would be costs that we are going to have to pay even if the deal doesn't get closed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yes, again, I'm coming up with...
So we would pay for the yellow book appraisal.
Right.
We would pay for the review appraisal, for the level one and level two environmental assessments, mm-hmm. and for Forterra staff time.
Okay. Those are all the questions I've got now. Thanks.
Councilmember Scarborough.
To put it simply, there's about three-thirds of this equation. Two-thirds are grants. Say it's $1.5 million. Two-thirds we have in grants. That's $1 million. The other $500,000 we're borrowing from Forterra. And we have to repay it within 3 years. Is that what I understand?
Right. So,
or extend.
Right. So,
but
right.
At any rate, the homeowner, the landowner, has gotten their money.
If they're able to close the deal with Forterra, so uh-huh. Forterra and the homeowner are able to come to, or the property owner are able to come to a purchase and sale agreement, and they close that purchase and sale agreement, the city then would be responsible for repaying Forterra. And right now, we have $500,000 towards that repayment. And we don't know what the purchase and sale agreement, what the price that's going to be agreed to by the parties would be.
But weren't we expecting another $500,000 in some grant too?
We're expecting another $1 million in grants, but those aren't secured, and we won't know the outcome of those until about mid-October.
But when we do, if we get them, then there's a chance that it's paid for.
It could be. It depends, again, upon the purchase price between the Forterra and the property owner.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Councilmember Hanford.
Thank you. So, just following up to clarify, the city has submitted two RCO grants for a total of $1 million. That's separate from the $500,000 that's already secured.
Exactly.
Okay. The $500,000 is from the county conservation futures.
Okay.
Which you pay in your property taxes.
Yeah, so I definitely want to see everyone walk away from this happy. But I can't help but think that we were just talking about North Kelsey like two meetings ago, and everyone's saying we need to get out of the business of land ownership. And so maybe you guys can help enlighten me on how this is really different than the whole North Kelsey thing, because I want to help everyone, and I want to see that land to be nature forever. Forterra will be super happy. All the neighbors on the hill will be super happy. The landowner will have gotten their money. Everyone will be happy. But
the city's got the bill.
But
plus grants.
Here we are, landowners again. So, Jason.
Councilmember Gamble?
I think the difference is because you're doing it through grants. I mean, that's really it. You're not using, you know, bonds towards us. You know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, that's right. You know, I see the difference. Totally get what you're saying, because I'm one of those ones that has absolutely said that.
Yeah.
You know, that we don't want to, you know, be in that, you know, that business. But that would just be my, you know, my first blush at it is that. And I think it's also it's a strategy for the decision as well from a council perspective of, you know, if we feel that this is an opportunity that we don't want to develop that, we don't want that developed out there, right? Just like we just went through and looked at stuff for zoning and, hey, we want this to be light industrial or we want this. Okay, here's an opportunity. We can make that just like you did with unicorns running through the area there. This is an opportunity to secure that through grants. As opposed to if we just say, you know what, we're just going to write it out, then, you know, hey, whatever, based on the zoning, right, whatever is sold, it gets put in there, So that would be my thought on the difference between North Kelsey and the NAS.
Yeah. I guess, having been on the side of making grants, it always irritated us when we heard that people were just banking on the grant because they were hoping that, you know, they've always come through, so we'll come through again. And so grants aren't a for sure thing. So yeah, we've got $500K and possibly $1 million. Just because you apply for a grant doesn't mean it's solidified by any means. And so, best case scenario, we've got $1.5 million, and who knows what the appraisal comes in at. So whatever the difference is, we're stuck with applying for more grants, which are not for sure thing whatsoever. Worst case scenario, we don't get $1 million, so now we're stuck with $500,000. That's all we got. So now we have to apply for a lot more grants and possibly not meet the 3-year deadline. So I'm not opposed to the idea totally, but I'd really love to hear more thoughts on, more feel-good thoughts that this is going to work.
More unicorns?
Yeah.
No, so, I mean, the counter to that is that, you know, hey, we just, it's a bridge loan, right?
It's a bridge loan.
It's a bridge loan is
absolutely
what it is. So, I mean, if your desire is we just want to continue to look until we actually secure all the grants, then you can absolutely, you know, do that. You know, but I'm not going to let my personal thoughts at this time, you know, go through. I'm just trying to look at all of the you know, the different options. But yeah, it's a bridge loan to act now. That's what we're looking at.
Right, and there's no pressing. Is there a timeline press?
That's a good question. Is there a timeline on the $500,000 that we've already secured?
So the $500,000 we could probably hold for 18 months to 2 years maximum. And at that point, then, if we haven't secured additional funds or we haven't been able to purchase, you know, a portion of the property, you know, then we're going to have to return the $500,000. And again, that'll potentially get us through the, you know, the second round of grant funding, right? Here in 2 years from October, you know, whether or not we've been able to secure property. I agree. I mean, that's the reason why I'm bringing this to you, is because I think it does involve a little bit of risk. Absolutely. I think the benefit, though, is that, as you mentioned earlier, I think it does provide a win-win for everybody. Mm-hmm. And that win happens a whole lot sooner under this scenario than if we choose to wait and see whether or not we can collect the money through, you know, another couple of years worth of grants. I have to say that this property has a lot of habitat value that I wasn't necessarily aware of when I started this project, and that I think the opportunity for grants is a whole lot better than I had anticipated originally. So from that perspective, it's just a matter of timing. Grants take a lot of time to apply for, I think you mentioned that, and they're competitive, right? And so there's not necessarily a known outcome. I think that Forterra's business model is to secure properties that are like this and to assist property owners to preserve a piece of property. And so I feel pretty confident that as long as we're working towards a positive outcome, the likelihood of Forterra not working with us to extend the MOU is pretty limited. That risk, I think, is very, very small. I think their desire is to preserve the property, and so even though the MOU allows them an out if they need to take it for some reason, I don't think that they're going to exercise it on this piece of property. They have a much bigger perspective of the Skykomish River Valley, and if you go onto their website, they describe how they're trying to preserve land within the Skykomish Valley that is just like this piece of property. They also have their own private donors. It's not their first stop, but I think, again, they need to get people excited about this piece of property, and securing it would allow them to do that and to start to tap into their private donor group. But without doing this memorandum of understanding, it's much more difficult for them to reach that money.
Anything further, Councilmember Hanford? Councilmember Gamble, you were next. Anything further?
Oh, I thought I had the floor.
Yeah, I did too.
Okay, well, you two were sort of going back and forth. So yeah. Councilmember Gamble, and then Councilmember Davis, and then Councilmember Camp.
No, I'm good.
Okay, Councilmember Davis?
Well, what you said was what I was thinking. When you know, 2 years ago, this was a non-starter. It wasn't even thinkable. When you brought that up a few months ago, it was like, that's a possibility. That's something that could make everybody happier, possibly. And so I was very interested in that. But the question was, is anybody interested in doing that? Well, what I'm encouraged by is the amount of feedback that you've got. We've already got $500,000 promised. We've got the possibility of another million. You know, that's a lot better than I was thinking. So, I mean, there's my unicorn.
Councilmember Davis found his unicorn.
Yes, there's some risk involved. But it's not that speculative deal that Kelsey was. You know, that was $12 million. And the worst case scenario happened, the market collapsed. It's still a lot of money, but it's not anywhere near that. And we've already got money promised, and we've got the possibility and some time to get more money on this. And I think it's a golden opportunity. I think I would love to see this settled, and I would love to see it settled with everybody coming out with a smile. So if we have that opportunity,
okay. Thank you. Councilmember Camp.
I can't get the picture of a smiling unicorn out of my head. It's just not going.
I think they're always smiling, sir.
I agree with you. I was concerned with the Kelsey issue and how we're getting into the property purchasing again. And like Councilmember Davis, I agree. I want this settled. I want it. That's been my goal for years and years. But I have to ask. I have to be the pessimist. Worst case scenario, we've got $500,000. We can't get the $1 million. Do we have an estimate of what our payments would be? I mean, I'm concerned about our Kelsey payments that we are trying to take care of. But what would an equivalent payment be for this property through?
I actually wouldn't suggest that you go out and borrow money to buy this. You've got sufficient funds available in your real estate excise tax in order to make an acquisition if you needed to. I don't know, Ms. Hassard, any
So,
input.
Well,
so
I mean,
wait.
We've got this interest agreement that we've got here.
Oh, the 110 to the 300,000 in the interest payments?
Is that their maximum interest payment?
Right.
We'd be able to make our payment. Like I said, my big concern is if we're going to be buying property, then we're dealing with Kelsey and we've got these enormous balloon payments we've got to take care of. Do we have a similar situation here?
No. So okay. With
That's
this particular property, so the way I understand it, and I don't know all the ins and outs, the way I understand it, Soterra is interested in this because it's very, very right to be like a passive park. You know, it's preserving open space, it's got the habitat issue.
Educational component.
Educational component. The key word is park. And one of the allowed uses of real estate excise taxes, the first quarter percent, is to purchase land for parks.
Okay.
So that is a revenue stream that we have available that we can use in this instance that is not available for North Kelsey. Because the underlying purpose of that purchase was very different. So from that aspect, we have already taken a look at what we have in real estate excise taxes. So if worst case scenario did happen, we would have the money to be able to do that. You would lose some opportunities in other areas or delay some opportunities in other areas, but it's not going to be the same type of situation where you had to go out and get borrowing and then have this balloon payment hanging over your head.
Okay. That was my question. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions or comments on this? The goal is to bring this back to council for consideration for a vote next week. If you have any questions that come up over the course of this week, please contact Ms. Knight so that Councilmember Hanford.
That reminds me, I will not be here next week.
Okay.
So, do you care to vote on it right now?
We have nothing to vote on right now. Okay, let me take a look at the agenda. I think I know where we are in the agenda, but before I cause a motion to occur. Okay, do you have anything further this evening?
Don't, thank you.
We have nothing further this evening.
Motion to adjourn.
Second. Okay, I have a motion to adjourn from Councilmember Gamble, a second from Councilmember Hanford, and a discussion on the motion. Saying none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Abstentions? Motion passes 6-0. Thank you very much, everybody. We are adjourned.
Thanks again.
If any of you guys have any questions or you think about it later, give me a call. I'm happy to take you through it.